Before getting into the episode that follows, I want to provide an update that came from the most recent Landmine Monitor report. It concluded that Myanmar has recorded the largest number of annual casualties from landmines for the first time in its reporting. As the country marks this grim milestone, Insight Myanmar is producing a monthly series, Navigating a Minefield, centering on the people at greatest risk as well as survivors of traumatic attacks. The series will feature Burmese and international experts providing important context about landmine use and explosive remnants of war endangering communities across the country. In cooperation with our media and humanitarian partners, we hope that this vital information will support risk education, raise awareness, and inspire action based on our shared responsibility to end this terrible threat to civilians. More about the episodes, as well as risk education resources, are available on the Insight Myanmar website. For now, let's get into the episode that follows. We'd like to welcome Myat to Insight Myanmar podcast, and we are going to start out by checking in with her about some of the women leaders of the revolution, of the democratic movement, of the ethnic organizations, and what attention they're being given and what role they're playing. This is a very important topic that we have followed across several past conversations on our platform over the years, and one that we're continuing to prioritize. So with that, Myat, I'd like to thank you for joining us here at Insight Myanmar podcast and sharing your views.
Yeah, thank you so much in welcoming me. Yeah. Yeah, for the women voices, I think we can talk about maybe like two folds, you know. We also have this kind of like activists and, you know, civil society organizations, women leaders from there. We can also look into these interim institutions, women leaders from there. What I mean by that is like we have this let's say from NUG ministry, we have like Ministry of Women, Youth and Children Affairs Minister, you know, what they are doing. And at the same time, we have this committee representing the Piransu Lutto, which was formed, you know, after the military coup. And then we have the women leaders there as well. Because I think, I've been thinking, you know, we've been talking about those support, what women, like women empowerment, let's say. So what do you mean, you know, women empowerment is not... To me, like, we really need to have data or, like, talk to those women who are actually working on those matters. For example, like this, I know some women, let's say this chair from IR Committee, from Committee Representing the Piransu Lutto, you know, she is also representing, advocating, and, like, visibility of this resistance movements and the Myanmar struggle. And then we have women, like, those passionate women out there, I think we really need to support them, the support they want to receive. So I think that matters a lot. It's not like we cannot just generally say that, like, oh, we have to support and empower women, and we are like forgetting about those women who are actually taking a role, you know. So I mean that's my general thought on that, because there are many, like, for example, there are Myanmar Women Parliamentarian Network, you know, who has also formed after the coup. They come out with this letter MPs, you know, in the 2020 elections, and they are, some are in the liberated areas, you know, some are in abroad, some other countries, and some are stay inside, you know. They are also stay trying to reach to their constituencies, and we have, I have some experience, like, I have some connection with them, and then I think they are the ones who really we should focus on supporting.
Why do you think that is? Why do you think that these are the ones that are so important to remember to support and focus on?
Yeah, so firstly, like those are, because when we talk about women in politics, let's say like inclusion, and then how are we going to include, like who are we going to include? Is this like just a general woman and going and asking how you should participate in the politics, or, you know, who are already serving the people, who have their like objective to serve the people. So if we have those women, that might be just like less portion, you know, it might not be many, but to my experience, there are many women MPs out there who are struggling with their ordinary life, and at the same time, they still continue to participate in this politics because we have less voices. So if like... Yeah, so that's what I think, because we really need to focus on those who are in taking, like I said, taking a role, you know, taking an initiative already. Because if you want to include, you cannot just start from scratch, and then you cannot just, maybe some women like to cook and stay at home, you know. So women in politics who are passionate, who have resources, you know, who have capacity, and then who are also elected legitimately. So I think that is a start, like how I think, because what else are we gonna do if we don't support those women, you know, if they want to continue like this revolution, supporting the people, serving the people.
What are some of the challenges that women MPs face that their male counterparts do not?
Challenges. I think when it comes to differences, I think in this, after the coup, both women and men, I believe we cannot just underestimate what men are, men might be facing the challenges. So I don't want to say who is bigger, but of course, like, women are vulnerable for sure. So I can say this, like sexual abuses or violence, assault, harassment. So that's what men do towards women, right, in general. But like nowadays, it's not like we are in the, for example, I don't mean the case of Myanmar, but in general, in the modern age, women also has a say, and, you know, in some cases, even women are like dominating the home, or, you know, so there are cases, but in case of Myanmar, there are the cases stay because we have this like patriarchy society in Myanmar. So I think maybe this kind of sexual abuse and violence and things like that are what women might face or what men, male counterparts might not face. And at the same time, when it comes to political view, I mean, I don't know, male might think differently, you know, maybe they have more, like, when it comes to defense or, you know, strategies, I don't have data in my mind, you know, who might know better. But then, I mean, biologically or, yeah, maybe male has more experience. So when women are in politics, maybe they may have to struggle on those matters more and maybe need more capacity. That's my general thinking. But I like, there are more women, like very smart women out there who are better than those men who are doing nothing and, you know, not even being part of any initiative. So, yeah, majorly I would just say, like, this sexual, like, abuse kind of step in this field, you know, in the revolution stage. And also when you are a woman and then you are a politician or, let's say, members of parliament, and you take care of your family, you have small kids at home, like, the kids rely on the mom, not on the dad. So it's just a basic. So I did those kind of stuff.
Right, yeah. Now, there's this really interesting case study of Aung San Suu Kyi, mm-hmm. because she is obviously a woman who has ascended to... tragically, she's now in prison, but over the years, she had ascended to the leader of the Democratic Movement and then state counselor, and there's many, you know, there's many ways to look at Aung San Suu Kyi, but if we just look at it through a gender basis, There have been very different interpretations of her as a woman politician. There has, of course, through the activist community, the narrative that was formed around Burma in the 1990s and beyond, there was this extremely compelling picture of this graceful woman with a jasmine flower in her hair that was, yeah, you know, standing up to this cruel and vicious military. And just, it was, you know, if you're looking for symbolism and something to rally around, it's hard to find something as just as profound and powerful as that image. And certainly there were, you know, certain photographs that really stood out just of her, you know, of her feminine stature, yeah, resolute and passionate and directed, but, you know, in the form of a woman and a feminine leadership that that really, you could say, formed some of the early narrative in the West of the Burma cause. And you know, and certainly it's nothing to turn your head from or to dismiss that there is this strong woman leader that can't be taken away. There is this strong woman leader who has emerged and who has captured the hearts of so many and who has become such this thorn in the side of military for so many years. They didn't know what to do with this one little woman. I mean, there is that part of the story there. And yet when she then was in power, and you know, of course it was never full power because the military was always there in the shadows, but we've had several guests on who have been very critical from a gender point of view. And I'm thinking of one Burmese feminist scholar who came on and made the comment that just because you have a woman leader does not mean you have a feminist policy. These are two separate things. And that you can't look at Aung San Suu Kyi as one person that indicates the liberating and equal roles that women have in Burmese society. This is just one particular case, and you have to look society-wide at what's being done, and there's still many, many problems that Aung San Suu Kyi herself, and whatever her capacity was, wasn't addressing in the way that she could, according to some of the guests that have come on. And so just in the form of this one figure, we have these arguments coming from very different sides as to what she represented as a woman leader and what she did for other women of the country. And of course, you also can't overlook her elite status of, you know, the family she grew up in and the kind of venue she grew up. She was certainly not someone coming from a small village life and ascending in that way. And so I, you know, this is a very complicated and nuanced question, but I wonder, as a young woman yourself, what do you see in Aung San Suu Kyi? Do you see things in her that give you a sense of inspiration and for yourself of what you can do? And at the same time, do you also see things of where she as being a young woman of a younger generation, seeing that there's things that maybe she didn't get, or that there were biases or things that she could have done more for this cause that she did not?
Yeah, it's a lot. I totally agree with that feminist scholar who talk about it's not enough with only one women leader, and you're not going to cover all the, you know, gender perspective in the country's need or in the decision-making position, the more inclusion of women or supporting towards women. Yes, that is not possible, but it doesn't necessarily mean, you know, this women figure is not something great. Because I think it's like you ask, if you ask me, like, do you think if it is inspiration, I would say so. Because regardless, you know, we cannot just blame on her because how she grew up. You know, she also like has some family problems she has to deal with, you know, as a mother, you know, all of her sacrifices. I think I'm not just citing her, you know. And then, I mean, like you said, she stood up, you know, in this military with the guns and these all the military strong, powerful men, and she stood up as a woman, and that's why they are afraid of her and they lock her up. We should not forget about it. Mm. You know, if she is not doing something like to support Myanmar or to do something good toward Myanmar and to do against the military, they will never lock them, lock her up. So I think, I mean, at her age, imagine that. I mean, I can only empathize. I look at her son, you know, speaking out, yeah, willing to. I mean, if you ask me as a young woman, can you stay in prison for one night? I don't think, mm-hmm, I will survive. Like, I think I'm a little bit spoiled, to be honest. Mm. Because even though, like, of course, like we are ordinary citizens, I didn't come from a rich background, but those are just how to call it, my empathy. And then, like, I really think she is a inspirational leader. But I think to be honest, you know, not only about Aung San Suu Kyi, to our Myanmar case, people want to see it so perfectly, like to the West, people from the West, for example, with their like international standards. And, you know, when you start the democracy, you should do this, you should do that. Come visit Myanmar, you know, how we have developed, how we have overcome. Look at our story. And then we need to, like, get evolved in, like, in many other societies. We are starting from scratch and, you know, from this, like, military rule over, like, seven decades of this military rule and, like, civil war and everything. And then when the civilian government booms, you know, starts, then we are applauding. And then, like, there are a lot of diplomats we need to give credit to. You cannot just say, hey, you're not covering, like, there is, you can only do so much, right? So they had only had started one time. I mean, yes, it is not perfect, but which, like, what kind of government is perfect? Look at this democratic, mature countries like the U.S., you know, what is happening there? Like, what is happening to that? So, I mean, yeah, it's not perfect. If we have, let's say, democratic, if we are not in the revolution right now, you know, not the conflicts and in the normal situation, if we don't like the government, let's say, we will have the election, you know, if we don't like the election, like, electoral system, we will change that. That's how the way we should do. So we will be, like, I think eventually we will be developed and, you know, so that's how we cannot just with one government term. I think it's too unfair to, I also criticize. I mean, like, that's what we can do as civilians, right? We say about, oh, what is this? Like, this is not fair, you know, what is happening? Like, it's not like we're going to cite, we're going to talk about it and then do something about it. But it's not like, hey, like, we talk about it today and you're a government, why are you not doing that? So I think it's a little bit unfair, just fine. In a short period of time, you want to change everything and then, like, look at our resources, and, you know.
I think that some of the criticism I've heard, and again, I'm at this point, we're only speaking of really her role in gender equality and women, because there's so much we could talk about with Aung San Suu Kyi, but as that's the point and perspective you came on, I just want to be clear with our audience, there's so many other things we could talk about with her leadership, but we're really just talking about this point in an isolated way for the nature of this conversation. And I think that if I'm recalling, and this was years ago, we had this conversation, so it's definitely taxing my memory to try to remember all that this scholar, this feminist scholar, said at the time and some of the points that she made. But I think that her disappointment wasn't so much in what Aung San Suu Kyi accomplished or not. It was in what she set out to accomplish and what it looked like her her priorities were. And I think one of the concerns was that she didn't surround herself by many women. It was mostly and it was a largely the cabinet was largely made of males, and there were a lot of older Bamar males, and so it didn't really look that diverse or different aside from her at the top. And another concern that was expressed was how NLD and her administration was really being lobbied by different advocacy groups at the time to do more in protecting women and empowering women. And we also can't forget this was the time of the race and religion laws that were that were out there, that were, you know, definitely very biased, not just towards not just in limiting women, but anti-Muslim as well. It wasn't what she wasn't being judged by what she was or wasn't accomplishing, but what she was or was not trying to accomplish. And this scholar did not see her motivations as being properly aligned with some of the interests of these gender equality activist groups. So,
I think I can understand her frustration, and I'm not saying, like, I disagree. Yeah, I don't think it was like. There were a lot of things missing, but at the same time, there were a lot of things to deal with. That's how I see it. And then, But I don't get it. Like, I don't understand why. Because just because you are a women leader, just because you care about the, like, inclusion of the women, you need to be surrounded by the women. I don't really get that concept, because maybe I'm not that feminist at that point. Because, for example, me myself, I love women. I love to. I'm not feminist, but any great women, you know, like it's, I have my best friends, you know, first friends group or girls, and I am always here to support them whatever they need, like inside, some else. And then not only my friends, like I think all my families and relatives, and also not even my relatives, but the women like who are struggling right now. I'm always looking. What should I do? What can I do? Right. So, but it doesn't mean I'm not surrounded myself with women, because it's difficult for me sometimes, because maybe right now there are not many women like to be surrounded by. There are many second brothers. Just because you want to support women, you need to be surrounded by women. And it's a little bit, I don't know. I don't understand that. But yeah, maybe she has a point. So
I don't think, just to clarify, I don't think the concern was that she wasn't surrounded by women. It wasn't that she was expecting that Aung San Suu Kyi would have a coterie of women that were around her all the time. Yeah. It was the opposite. It was that she was surrounded by men. Yeah. There wasn't even a minimal representation of women around her in the cabinet or as advisors. Oh, yeah. That it was so. You know, if you had a man in the role of a leader that surrounded himself with so many men, you would call that out for, you know, not really being very inclusive.
Of course, yes. I think, yeah, now I understand. So maybe like her policies, you know, she didn't really push through maybe like to maybe some gender quota she must be saying about. In that case, yes, we must agree that there must have been a gap, you know. And I think she, even her assistants, like was Dr. Dima was with her. Well, yes, you are not talking about that. You are talking about like cabinet. And so, I mean, when we talk about this women leadership and women inclusion, we look at the Southeast Asia, you know, women participation at the parliament in Myanmar. I don't think it was the lowest. I don't exactly remember. It was like 13% of women participation at the parliament at the time. I wouldn't say it was like too little compared to, of course, to the West. I'm not quite sure, but in Southeast Asia, as far as I understand, I remember Myanmar was not at the lowest when it comes to that. But when we look at the cabinet members, but maybe not, the numbers are not that add up. So yeah, she must be right. And then there was, like I said, you know, she is one body, like she is also try. It's not like she's a god and, you know, have to tackle everything and what military has done and has to cover everything they have done, you know. So, yeah, she might have been, but I mean, I cannot suddenly say that because I don't have the numbers in my mind. But when I look at it, it is not like systematically she is excluding women. I would disagree with that. But I mean, if you don't have the policy, that's the problem, right? So, yeah.
Right, so let's move on to the point that you started this conversation with, and that was the role that you're seeing of women leaders today in the revolution, and circle back to some of your views and thoughts about the importance of what they're doing and getting their voices out there.
Yeah. Getting their voices out there, I mean, can be many, many forms. How we can do that, like I said, from this women MPs, you know, they can do advocacy works a lot if we can support them to be at the international forums, conferences, to speak out, to be recognized as a legitimate government, you know, a legitimate parliament, parliamentarians. So I think that's one thing. And at the same time, the other women, like in the, for example, If you mean like the leaders or like this, also people from the People Defense Forces, you know, they are the women who are fighting in the front line. So we can support whatever they need. That might be like a emotional need, you know, in if you are on the ground. Money, you know, and like food, like basic needs, we need to support, and then so that they can continue whatever they are doing. And if they're the women leader, I think capacity needs, they must have like some thematical topic they need to know before they go talk in front of the international community and then speak out about what is happening and like what military has been committing these crimes. And so I think that can be both. Yeah. Also, we can also support civil society organizations at the same time, you know, but who are working on the women groups, you know, women matters, and yeah.
What do you see of the women representation currently in NUG?
Currently in NUG, well, we have this FTC, right? There is this, like, they had the roadmap to have, like, 30% of quota have already included. That's, I think, good sign. Mm. If you mean in NUG, we have, as I mentioned, Ministry of Women, Youth and Children Affairs, and the Deputy Minister is also women. So those are the women ministries. Of course, they are the women leaders. But other than that, they are not women leaders. So I see it's, we cannot say that this is enough. But at the same time, we cannot, I don't think we can complain about that, looking at the what is happening. Maybe, like I said, women are struggling. Like you asked your question, you know, what might be those women like who are struggling, who might be struggling with the struggle which the male counterparts might not be struggling with. So it's not like every woman, even though we want to include women, it's not like every woman are into politics. That's one thing, right? So we cannot just grab every woman and like empower women. So I think it's just pointless. But in our situation, like with our development and progress in my country, so human resource, you know, even though we have many women, like half of the country is women, but it doesn't mean everybody can just, oh, like, you know, go to the leadership position and work on that. I don't think we want that, because it's not like we are discriminating. So also at the same time, they need to have the willingness. So do we know, like, who are women who are willing to participate in this, let's say, ministerial positions and when to lead and have the full capacity? And then if those women are not getting the support they need, we need to speak out about it. But right now, I don't think... Yeah, that might not be the number we want, I would say so. We have to, like, keep supporting the capacity need or whatever, but, like, immediately change, I don't think it is that easy. You have to, of course, you have to work on that. Of course, like, I want to see, I will be biased, because it's not like I'm feminist, but I would love to see, like, many women in the leadership position. But it's not that easy. It's, like, you know, it's... easier said than done. Like, we need more numbers. We also need the quality number. That's what I think.
I noticed that several times in this conversation you've made a point to say you're not feminist, and so I'm curious about how you define the word feminist and how you're navigating your support and encouragement for female representation, and that being a big part of your of your motivation and your values, but yet this term feminist is something you don't identify with. So I'm wondering if you can unpack that and explain that.
Yeah, if you want me to clarify with the term, maybe I may not be able to answer in a specific technical way. But I mean, I look at the women, like feminist movements, like just if like you speak of something, you know, what women are not getting. In a very powerful way, and then like really vocal about it. I don't think I am that, to be honest. If it is part of feminist movement, I am not that side of feminist. I just don't want to shout like women are getting. Like, I want to see what they need, and like I want to know who they are, and then we say women and men, but we are all human, right? So I think we have to see it from the human perspective. And then, like, if we say human, like, I think I care about both men and women who are in need of help. I'm more like a humanist. Mm-hmm. So that's how I see. But at the same time, like I said, maybe from the education I received, you know, and then also I myself as a woman, and I don't see me being different from men from any... I don't think I'm being discriminated or I am a victim, because I have never experienced that, and I want to be equal. But of course, there are the things men can only do. No, women cannot do. I cannot hold a lot of heavy stuff. That's the truth. I cannot be fighting. There are the women who can fight in war. But of course, if it is essential, I need to do it right away, because there is no option. I need to do that. I have to. There is no option, right? If there is option, I don't think I am that strong to be. So I, in that sense, men are more powerful. That's how I see it, like feminism or whatever. You know, we're going to just be like being equal. It's not like we need to be equal all the time. Things are not equal in the world. We need to understand that. That's how I see it. But at the same time, I have a little bit bias, of course. Like, I always have that, like, I need to, when I see women friends, or like, I need to be ready, you know, then discriminate men a little bit sometimes. I don't know. Yeah. I have that kind of side, but it's not like I'm still empathetic towards in every people, I think, humans.
Right. Okay. So shifting gears a bit to look at, again, this topic of female representation across the board, we've talked a bit about the MPs, NUG, NLD, and Aung San Suu Kyi. Let's talk about the ethnics. What have you seen, and what can you tell us about the role that women leaders and women voices have come to play across ethnic communities?
Yeah, I think in many like constituencies, for example, in ethnic regions, Chin or Shan, I think they are also women representatives there, and then they also maybe they are under the same political party, mm-hmm. you know, maybe that is not that diverse when it comes to political party, but there are women representatives from those constituencies in the ethnic region, and they are also those from those ethnic groups, so they know what is going on within their like ethnic groups or society, their needs, and they can represent. So there are those women out there. Yeah, I mean, current position, how I see is, I keep saying this, Myanmar Women Parliamentary Networks, right? Because I know what they are, I am aware of what they are, you know, trying to serve to the people. And so they normally reach out to those, their constituency playing their role as members of parliament. And then just like they normally do in the normal situation, listen to the voices from those constituencies, and then they report back or work together with this Ministry of Women, Youth and Children Affairs from NUG, and then from Women Matters. I mean, in some, mostly I've heard is, like I said, like a lot of sexual like gender-based violence or like domestic violence is going on, and there is a root cause. It's not only maybe there are some drug issue in those constituencies, so they get to know when they have. Maybe they cannot always do in person, like constituency, like town hall meetings. Mm-hmm. But they also organize those. So I think that is the least they can do right now as the members of parliament, and listening to what is actually going on, and then like what they can do, like supporting humanitarian aid. I think that's what they do firstly, and then that is also what is majorly in need right now. And then they also, speak out in the international forum about those issues. But of course, you cannot just solve every problem in like overnight. That will not be that easy with the resources, especially now, like US aid cut off, and there are a lot of humanitarian aid programs are also gone. So they that role they play, like listen to the people voices and at least understand the problem first, and that is also very important.
So I know the second topic that you wanted to get into, switching gears completely and moving in a totally different direction, still related to Myanmar, but on a different topic, is Buddhism. And I know you had some thoughts to share about this. So tell us what you want to share about your background or your observations of Buddhism in Myanmar.
Yeah, if we think of Buddhism, I firstly think of like Buddha philosophy. What the Buddha taught, you know, and then the right mindfulness. I think that's what is lacking right now in Myanmar. And then what military is doing is like totally against. And also at the same time, ironically, they are the monks, Buddhist monks who are siding. I'm not sure if you're aware like this.
Yeah.
So there are those like cases sadly, and this is complete opposite, because you know, if you talk about Myanmar, like, we have this majority of religious in Myanmar is Buddhism. So I'm saying, of course, every religion doesn't mean to do harm to the community. Every religion at their core has a great intention. And for Buddhism, I don't mean I'm a Buddhist, but I'm not like religious, but I just like the Buddha ideology and, you know, like this right mindfulness and then right action. So that is what I mean by like what is happening in Myanmar is lacking, especially what military is doing.
Did you grow up in a Buddhist household?
Yes. But I mean, it's everybody, I think. Technically, we are like typical Buddhist because my parents are Buddhist, and then but it's not like my mom pray, for example. But I think me and my dad at home, we never pray, but we meditate. So that is like I like the this meditation practice from the like Buddhism, practices.
What kind of meditation did you do, and how often did you practice it?
I do it every morning. So, like 30 minutes a day. And then I don't know how to call it because it has been evolving since I started doing it. And, you know, it is more like a concentration. I started with stress meditation, let's say, like just breathing in, breathing out, like being aware of your breath whenever you count. And then your thoughts comes and goes and let them comes and go. And then acknowledge them and then let them go. So mostly... Yeah, I'm like quite anxious person, mm-hmm. So I kind of need that to get my day going. So, I've been doing that, it is concentration side of meditation, and then I also try to like contemplate sometimes, just like doing nothing. And well, yeah.
Who's the teacher that you follow?
Well, great question. I read here and there. But I don't have the specific teacher. But I also listen to sermons sometimes. So they are the monks I like to follow. So even the between a man's monks, they are quite different the way they talk. So I just from my personal experience, what I can be adaptable. So I decide, you know, maybe this way is working, this way is not working, and then like eventually now it is not even like from the Buddha monks. So from the Western. Like Western practitioners talk about meditation, like Eckhart Tolle. So I also read his books, and then he also talk about. Yeah, he doesn't actually majorly prioritize on meditation. He mostly about, I think, spirituality for him. No. It's like consciousness. So yeah, I think those are all related. So I think kind of interesting.
So you grew up in Burma, and you came from a Buddhist household, and. You first began listening to the sermons, and we can say religious sermons of the Burmese monks, and that was and that continues to be part of your education and your growth and interest. And yet, you've also expanded to then listen to Western monks and practitioners, and even those that are not Buddhist, like Eckhart Tolle, and more spiritual. So, but a lot of these Western teachers are call themselves Buddhist or are have very much Buddhist philosophy in their teachings. And so, I wonder if, and actually, this is interesting because your development here is it's the reverse of mine, you know, and that's the way it is for most, you know, most of my Burmese friends and that have come to the West, in the sense that I began meditation here and then I went to Burma and I contrasted what I learned here to what I found in Burma. And for you and for them, it's the opposite. You started your understanding of Buddhism from birth in your native country, and then you came to the West and you started to see how Buddhism was practiced and talked about here. And so one of the things I've always enjoyed talking about is, and usually it's talking to Westerners about how the Buddhist practice they developed in the West that they then took to Burma, what changes and shifts they found in Buddhist practice in Burma that was different to how they had learned it here. So I want to ask you the reverse question. What, growing up in Buddhist communities and listening to Buddhist Burmese monks and then coming to the West and hearing Buddhist-inspired teachers here that you listen to, what differences and contrasts do you find in those different methodologies and understandings?
Oh my God. Yeah, it's very... Yeah, interesting question. I also see some evolution, you know, from my experience. If you, I think it makes sense since you come from the West, you start from there and then you go to, you know. But for me, I grew up in a typical Buddhist family, but I never had this kind of prayer practices. But I was mostly, yeah, like dealing with some stuff in my mind. That is also how I started the meditation practices. Initially, like I said, like counting the breath is very, very easy to do, right? Let's say count to hundreds. And then you stop breathing. And I was not doing well. I don't even know what is right or what is wrong. But I don't see much difference from... They might be saying different things, different stuff, but deep down, like this consciousness talking about and then like write action and do the stage of contemplation, you know, from concentration to... In that sense, I don't actually see much difference. I mean, it just makes more sense with your practice and then your personal experience. And then when you listen, you can elaborate more. So in the beginning, I didn't know that much. I knew about this contemplation side of this meditation practice. It's not like breathing in, breathing out, or sitting down in one position. That was a traditional way I learned in the beginning. But now, it is not from Western. I just didn't learn from my, like, when I was growing up. I just didn't know. I didn't actually follow through quite well. But you can also do it. Like, even when we are talking, just paying, sure, you know, being at the moment. Not talking, not thinking about what am I going to eat later. Right. Am I doing good? You know? So I think those kind of thinking, like, understanding comes up when I listen to this Western. They might not be saying like, oh, they say all about Christianity, you know, Akatoli also talk about Christianity and Buddhism. So, but I mean, I think they are in line. Like, so yeah, that's evolved. And then throughout the time, I think that's, but the, actually deep down, there is no big difference to me. And I'm still listening to like Buddha sermons from Buddha monks in Myanmar. And then I stay find fascinating, and I stay is modernized, and then, you know, stay catch up with actually with what the Western world is saying.
Can you give an example of that?
Do you mean the names?
Well, I would like to know the names as well, but along with the names, I'd also like to know an example of a recent Burmese Buddhist sermon you heard that you feel is, in your words, catching up with the West.
Yeah, so I also read the book. So this man called Usodika, if you know.
Snow and Summer.
He also talk in between, like use some English words.
Yeah.
I think I can relate to him more because let's say if we go to like Nandamala, if you know Nandamala. Yeah. So he's more like a little bit of, if I listen to this man very much, I mean, I just like don't want to do anything, and like it's really like have to give up on like my greed, and you know, I don't want to go that far, to be honest. No. I want to remain my human side. So like, okay, I have taken a fourth, but it doesn't mean I'm gonna give it up at all. But then like this Usodika, you know, for example, I was listening recently about your anger. Anger doesn't mean like I'm angry at you. I am angry at this bus, but I mean your concerns, your worry. It's part of anger. And then, like, once you notice that, you really realize that, and then you can actually bring back to what is actually right now, consciousness, and then you can control that, and then you will not suffer a lot from it.
Yeah.
So that one resonates with this Western way of saying, even you are in the queue, you know, waiting for some... Let's say I was queuing at the pharmacy yesterday, and then it is not like I have to have a major achievement. Like in this queue, am I not gonna be like, oh, I'm gonna miss my bus? Like I'm angry at this person, you know. I need to have this, like, okay, like everybody is, you know, taking, you know, having their pharmacy, and then they are as important as mine, and then just understand that, see it as that way, and then be patient, conscious, and like. Be able to deal with that kind of position, you know, becoming more, yeah. But it's not easy, of course. It's not like, I'm like that. I'm still, you know, irritated or frustrated. It's still with me. So, but of course, it's getting better. I don't think it will go away, eventually. And then I also know that, yeah, it's now I remember. When we meditate, it's like we want to achieve something. that is also something wrong. Mm-hmm. So it should not be something you want to achieve. And it is like in the beginning, it should not be about doing. It should be about being. If you're meditating, you know, just sit. That's why some Zen master, you know, just sit and do nothing. But it's not like, oh, I'm going to be more patient person later. I'm going to be a better person later because of this meditation practice. And greed is there already. And then if you start with that and you have timer sometimes, you know, oh, when am I going to stop thinking about that timer? So those things, I think we need to be aware. And then that is, something I've been realizing this, like compared to this monk I was listening to, if you have like a recent example. Yeah.
Yeah, well, you know, Ujjotika is a very different kind of Burmese monk. So, you know, just his background, his mind, his approach, he's definitely not a traditional or conventional Burmese Buddhist monk. He's not even, didn't even have a Buddhist upbringing. I mean, that's what makes him so unique, is that he came from a Muslim background and then converted to Buddhism. And so he came to it, and he was a chemistry student, if I remember. So,
I didn't know that.
He comes with a very different background than a lot of Burmese monks, and actually really, you know, tragically and unfortunately, there are many Burmese Buddhists who don't accept him, because even though he's a full-fledged monk and just a beautiful mind and thinker and teaching Buddhist meditation, the mere fact that he came from a Muslim family has been enough for some Burmese Buddhists to kind of pass him off and, you know, consider him not valid of a following, which to me is just absurd, because he's one of the greatest 20th century monks that the country's produced.
I agree, because we also have this problem with this. Now we know, right? We learn. I mean, that there was a lot of hatred towards this Islam community. It's like something you need to be scared of, and you know, bad people. But it's really bad. And then this man, I know that he also started the Buddhism, and like his, So it's really. Have you also read his books?
Oh yeah.
How do you read it? I don't think they have them in English.
Yeah, it's in English. I could tell you.
Really?
I could tell you a lot about Ujjotika. Actually,
one of my
good friends is Australian, and he was a monk for 15 years in Burma, and he is the only example I have ever heard in my life of someone of a foreigner, a Westerner, who was a Sayada at a monastery in Burma for 3 years. He was an Australian who was a monk in the 1980s, and he was a Sayada for 3 years at his own monastery. I've never heard of another example of that. His story is there is no story like it that I've heard from Burma. And he told his whole story to us on Inside Myanmar for 6 hours, which was scheduled to be published on February 2nd, 2021. And after the coup, he asked us, given how sensitive his story is and how many things he goes into, he asked us not to publish the story. And so it's kind of the greatest interview that we've never released. And I don't know if we ever will release. But where I'm going with this is that he lived with Ujjotika in the forest, the two of them together, for years. They were basically roommates in the forest. Ujjotika taught him Pali.
Oh, my God.
So much of my knowledge from Ujjotika comes from my Australian friend who was with him before he became famous. And actually one of his, he has several books that have been translated in English, Map of the Journey and Snow and Summer. And Map of the Journey it's a longer book, and it's based on, Ujjotika was invited to give a meditation course and a series of talks to Westerners. And in Australia, in fact, and after giving these talks, someone transcribed the talks and turned them into a book. And it's one of the great Burmese Buddhist books in English.
Oh,
it's really
see.
Fantastic. And there's a dedication on the front of the book to another Burmese monk saying, you know, thank you for making this happen. Most foreign meditators I know that have been to Burma have read this book. It's available in all the bookshops, and it's just a great Dhamma book. It was years later that I found out that, so I know my friend is no longer a monk. He's now a lay person. And I know his lay name, obviously. I won't share it here, but the dedication of this book, Map of the Journey, is a dedication to my friend. It's to his monk name. It's to his Pali name, which I didn't know. And it was my friend who invited Ujjotika to Australia, who organized the course and who did the transcription of the book. Oh. So this book and this course exists because of my friend, that, you know, the story that was told. And so that is where most foreigners know of Ujjotika from the book Map of the Journey, which is he gave a series of English discourses and English meditation instructions to this foreign audience, which was then transcribed in English as he was talking and made into the book. And that's how most people know him, is this extraordinary book called Map of the Journey, which I had, you know, read and inspired me. And I got to know a lot about Ujjotika's kind of psychology and mind, you know, from reading this. And it was years later that I found out it was all because of my friend that book existed.
Wow. Yeah, your friend did a great job. And it's so weird. I never knew this, because I am a big fan of this monk.
Yeah.
I mean, I have read a couple of his books in Burmese.
Yeah.
I don't remember the name, but this is like my, I cannot live without them, but I don't have them now. So I have the sermons. So I listen at times, but not every time, because I listen this Western side of this spirituality and practices, because I want to see, like you said, I also want to see like differences.
Yeah.
And then like evolve myself, like, and my own practices and like know myself, you know, like a little bit. It's not like me, you know, go, okay, this is gonna be bigger push, and I'm talking about I and stuff like that. So I'm not saying that, but like just to know, me and relate with those practices. Yeah. So, but yeah, I'm gonna like find if I can order online. Or
I'm sure you can find an online copy. Yeah, Map of the Journey. That's the big one, and then Snow and Summer is another book that he just.
I will buy both of them.
Yeah,
definitely.
Yeah, let me know what you think. The other thing I want to talk about that you said a bit before is you were talking about the observation of different defilements, and in the example you gave, it was anger. You know, seeing anger as arisen, and as we're talking about contrast, I want to test this observation with you and get your feeling, because you're also moving from these cultures, albeit in the opposite direction. But one of the things that I observed when I first went is that as a Western practitioner that was being trained in the type of Vipassana meditation and observation that I was doing before, there was this sense that when say an emotion like anger would arise, we'll just use anger as the example, it could be anything else, but when anger arises, that there would be an awareness of the experience of anger. That's what I was trained to observe. And I would observe, you know, I'd observe the anger in all different forms, in short breathing, and, you know, my muscles getting tense, my body temperature getting hotter, also the mental contents of my mind, that I would observe how the mind would start to restrict when the anger came, how it would start to filter different information coming from the world to kind of fit my angry sense of mind to, you know, further justify it. So it's just kind of these sense door observations of anger and of the experience and phenomenon of anger. And when I came to Myanmar, I started to talk to fellow Burmese practitioners, I found a different way of dealing with, and of course, not to generalize, and they're, you know, there are many types of people and teachers that you talk to that have different understandings. But something I found quite prevalent was that among Burmese practitioners was that when anger would come up, they would deny it. And they would just say that anger is like a fire that burns. So I'm just not going to have it. I'm going to avoid it. And in some ways, I found this like a type of denial or suppression, because you know, there, I would find that when you were dealing with any of these defilements, but, you know, again, using anger as an example, sometimes you have the option, you know, anger is sitting right here, and you have the option of grabbing it and taking it and kind of absorbing it and associating with it. And in those cases, I think it's very wise discernment to see the anger sitting here and just say, I'm not going to touch that. I'm just going to leave that there. The Buddha said that anger burned, that it was a defilement, it was bad for me. I'm not going to bring this on or associate this. But in other cases, you know, we also have defilements that are inside us. And if you deny the existence of that anger, that doesn't mean you don't have anger. It doesn't mean it goes away. It doesn't mean it's not in you. In some ways, you have to do the messy, dirty, ugly, uncomfortable work of recognizing the phenomenon of the anger in you and observing how it comes up and how it manifests. And it's not enough to simply deny it, to simply say that, well, the Buddha said that anger is a defilement and we shouldn't have anger, so therefore I'm not going to have anger. That doesn't work. Yeah. That doesn't make it go away. And yet I would hear a number of practitioners speak in that kind of way. So I'm wondering, in your cross-cultural experiences, if you experienced in the West a more an approach that was more dealing with these defilements and emotions in direct ways of transparency and acknowledgement, and if in Burma you didn't come across that quite to the same extent, or what your thoughts are on that?
I totally agree, because I mean I have heard those monks like, but I don't think Buddha ever said that.
No,
just said like suffering right exists, yeah. And we have to. No, we have to learn the cessation of the suffering. That's what the Buddha taught. Like, you have to go really learn the what the Buddha taught. But, I mean, luckily, I have had those, like, oppression towards what is going on inside your body or your mind. Like, it is just bad. You should not have that. So,
yeah.
Yeah.
You've heard that, too.
Yeah, exactly. But luckily, you know, like, I think I came across the right teacher, like Uso Dika. So yeah. I was not in the wrong path. Mm. So I was on the right track, I think, since the beginning. But I came across those teachings as well. And then, like you, I definitely agree with you. When I learn more in the Western, you know, side, not only Buddhism or spiritual practices, but also about this like therapeutic, like healing, you know, tactics I have to learn from. I don't know which book or where, but never, you should not oppress. It is not wrong. It exists.
Yeah.
It exists. So you just have to accept them, acknowledge them, you know, tame them. So, well, tame them is not like getting rid of them, you know.
Yeah.
Just to get from, like, just don't react upon that. But you have to understand and you have to be aware when it arises, you know. But I'm not that, like, how to call it, that good or that good level yet. So I cannot elaborate in a good way. But exactly like in the Western side, I think it is more, I think on more like right track. You know, when it's explaining to us this kind of insight, like internet, your body scam or like whatever you're feeling arising, you should not oppress. Like that is more. They say more in the Western teachings, I think, than because. There could be some misleading practices if you were not with the like right teacher in the, because you know, like education, like we are quite we quite struggle with that. So even though like some monks have good intention, but they were not doing good job and saying like exactly what Buddha just did not teach, you know. So
yeah, and you're absolutely right. Just because the Buddha said that these are defilements that keep you from liberation, doesn't mean that when you identify these defilements in you, that you can just simply say you shouldn't have them and then you're not. I mean, this is, we talk about the outer oppression of the Myanmar military. There's an inner oppression of not allowing your, not allowing a clarity or an honesty, really, of what's in your mind to come out. And I understand it's a scary process because there are parts of all of us that are incredibly shameful and ugly and embarrassing and things that we don't want to have to admit about ourselves. And there are, you know, incredible teachers in Myanmar. You know, there is definitely a distinction between those really sharp and qualified teachers that are really pointing away towards a certain kind of practice. And then let's be honest, the wider Burmese Buddhist population that is not practicing as seriously or legitimately, you know, in every parts of their life. But I think of another teacher and a saying that I think of here, Sayadaw Utejaniya. And in one of the question and answers I was with him, I'll never forget this. I always laugh when I think about it. One of the students was talking about how, you know, they were having insights into just the manifestation of their ego and, you know, the things they were trying to hide from themselves and the selfishness and everything else, and how, like, learning this process was, it was cleaning them and liberating them, because they were learning more about the manifestation of the ego, and through that they were able to let go. But it was just this really painful process of discovery. And then kind of made a comment about how, you know, he thought he's coming to meditation to kind of get, you know, happy and balanced. And here he was just dealing with all this immense suffering. And Utejaniya laughed. I'll never forget this. He said, meditation, no good news. No good news. You know, you don't, the process of meditation does not have you, when you self-inquire about yourself, the answers you get back are not good news. You don't find out, gosh, I'm really a wise, peaceful, qualified, you know, compassionate individual. Those usually aren't the things you discover with genuine meditation. Usually you're discovering, my God, I'm like this and I have this quality, and, you know, it's this messiness.
You're more self-conscious.
But it's the honest acknowledgement and discovery of these really messy, uncomfortable parts of ourselves that we'd rather not admit. And it's the fearlessness and realizing that this is where the power of, you know, anicca and anatta come in. You know, anicca being impermanence and constant change, and anatta being no self. If things were permanent and things were self, we would be screwed. We would be doomed. You know, all of these issues that I have, I can never get rid of them, because these issues are mine and they will never go away. Yeah. But that's not the nature of existence. That's not the three characteristics. These issues that are coming, they're impermanent, they're constantly changing, and they're not mine. So all I have to do, well, not all I have to do, because it's a lifelong process and it's so hard, but I just need to disassociate with them. I just need to realize that this messiness coming in, it's only painful when it's my messiness, you know, when it's my pain, my struggles. That's what makes it terrible. Exactly. The minute we're able to recognize anger is anger, not my anger. Yeah. Depression is depression, not my depression. Addiction is addiction, not my addiction. The minute we do that, that's where liberation comes.
Yeah. Just right now, when you mentioned about ego, you know, that is one thing, like, I understood wrongly before. Maybe in Myanmar, like in front of Buddha, it's not like Buddha's, that from the teaching I got, like, for example, Sierra Uzodika never said that, but I thought, like, ego was bad, but, like, ego is not necessarily bad, you know. Everybody has ego.
Yeah.
It has, like, certain levels, you know, but you just have to know how to deal with your ego, and you have to acknowledge and understand that you have this ego. So this is the kind of process, as you said. So I just, like, reflect upon what you just mentioned, and that is, like, different. I think in Western world, they talk more about in forums, or, you know, kind of, let's say, kind of like empowerment talk, or psychological talk, you know, they mention that a lot about, like, you cannot oppress that. That's the same, like you said, this Honda, I mean, what happens.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, we are traumatized.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, the whole need.
Yeah. But
I think sometimes I feel guilty, you know, just to be secure, safe. And then, like, imagine those, like, who are not safe, and then I, like, guilty. And then, but at the same time, I try to understand that, you know, it's not like I made them to be this way. This is not me, you know, but I mean, I'm lucky to be safe and secure. And then sometimes we just have to take it. That's kind of sorrow, you know, like relatives, friends, all the friends are suffering. And then, so I try not to oppress my feeling, like, so traumatized. Recent earthquakes and what is people are going through. And sometimes you have this kind of things arise, like emotions, you know, like, why am I not in that trip right now? So, I mean, I might be, like, mentally struggling, but physically, like, obviously, you know, I am, like, quite safe, and, like, not even mention about, like, don't you dare mention your problems, you know. Many people out there have problems. Shut up, like, that's my inner voice. And then come up and, okay, like, yeah, I just need to behave sometimes, you know, something like that. That's, like, how to, do my self-talk sometimes.
Well, survivor's guilt is a major issue and complex of so much of the diaspora community.
Yeah.
You know, that's not something you're alone with. I think that for so many that care about their home country and their community there and that have the opportunity to get out, even if everything they're doing outside is supporting their country, even, you know, the salary they're earning is going towards CDM or humanitarian, and the work they're doing is going towards, you know, supporting the Myanmar Democratic Forces. And, yeah. you know, even if everything they're doing is continuing to support, just the fact that one got out of harm's way and is not facing the situation that those around are. I mean, that survivor's guilt is a major complex that so many Burmese are dealing with now.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's why, yeah, that is like, have to understand like daily how you're going to, when you look at the news, you have some excitement 1 second and later you read the news, you know, you are totally down and you cannot do anything, helpless, especially you're not in it, yeah. you know, there's both, like a lot of emotions came up, I think. Yeah. So, I mean, yeah, I mean, deal with it. Mm. yeah.
All right. Well, this has been a great conversation. It's been wide ranging, going from touching upon the voices and roles of women and women MPs and getting into meditation and Burmese Buddhism and Western mindfulness and then moving on just now to touching upon this issue of what it's like to be outside your home country in the diaspora. It's really touched on very disparate issues and brought them together. And I thank you so much for your time in navigating these topics.
Thank you so much for your time. And I want to, if I may, you know, deliver, taking advantage of this stage and just to deliver to the international community, you know. So I understand there are the governments, neighboring governments of Myanmar, you know, who like to support the people of Myanmar and who are trying to. And at the same time, there are some who continue to side with the military junta. So, I mean, I hope they understand this. Under military rule, Myanmar will never become a developed or stable country. And in the long run, having an underdeveloped and stable neighbor doesn't benefit anyone. And do the governments in the West, you know, looking at this Russian-Ukraine war, if you see Putin as a global threat, you must also see how military junta in Myanmar is strengthening ties with him. Ending dictatorship in Myanmar is not just about Myanmar. It is protecting democracy and peace globally. It's like a butterfly effect. Just because, you know, Myanmar feels far away doesn't mean what happens in Myanmar won't affect the rest of the world. So restoration of democracy in Myanmar is part of building sustainable peace everywhere. So I truly hope, you know, this international government understand this and then take action on that and then continue supporting Myanmar. Don't forget Myanmar. Yeah, thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Insight Myanmar Podcast. Producing these conversations takes dedication and resources, and through this process, we're committed to keeping them freely available for everyone. But to make this work sustainable, we do need your help. If you've enjoyed this episode or found it valuable, and if you listen to our platform on any somewhat regular basis, we ask you to consider supporting us with a recurring donation. It doesn't have to be much. Think of it as buying us a cup of coffee each month. That small gesture of committing to just, I don't know, $5 a month can make a big difference in helping us to continue bringing these stories. And if you're feeling more generous, increasing the monthly pledge will allow us to produce even more on our end. In any case, any level of support goes directly towards amplifying the voices and stories that matter. This not only keeps us going, but ensures that these important conversations reach more people around the world. To make a contribution, visit insightmyanmar.org/donation or look for Insight Myanmar on PayPal or Patreon. Dadu ya dalam biar di ganesa di mana wika dah biasa ya enak biasa ya.
Oh, da, yarananda, da, yarananga, da, yarananga, da, yarananga, da, yarananga, da, yarananga.